Welcome to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. Today's episode is even more poignant and ultra relevant due to multiple devastating fires in Los Angeles right now. The future really is up to us. You can follow resources like Watch Duty app and fire.gov for resources and reach out to friends and neighbors who may need your help. Stay safe, everybody. We all could use a little bit of hope right now. And today's guests are here to give us just that. As the fearless leaders of the Environmental Defense Center, a public interest law firm on California's Central Coast, Alex Katz and Linda Kropp have been engaging in environmental battles with David and Goliath odds and winning for the past 30 years. In this conversation, Linda and Alex share their insights on some of the urgent challenges faced along the coast of Santa Barbara, an area that Franklin Roosevelt called the Galapagos of the Northern Hemisphere due to its diverse habitat and marine life. Of particular interest is their current fight with Sable Offshore, a small and highly leveraged startup that's trying to restart a 28-year-old corroded pipeline that burst just 10 years ago, dumping 143,000 gallons of crude oil. They highlight the power of community involvement, expert and relentless legal action, and policy change that can drive meaningful progress. We recorded this episode at the end of 2024, and since that time, the state fire marshal has waived safety requirements for restarting this known faulty pipeline. Join us for inspiring discussion with two superheroes who have dedicated their brilliant careers to safeguarding the environment for future generations. Hello, Alex and Linda. I'm so happy to see you both here today. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Stacey.
Absolutely. Well, I am so interested to kind of dive in more to what you guys do here in the community of Santa Barbara County. We met not too long ago relative to an important environmental case that's on deck right now. And you have been busy protecting the environment in my area for a long time, and I'm so thrilled to know you. So I'd love to start with you telling us what it is that you do. Talk to me about that. Let's start there.
Thank you again for having us on. EDC, Environmental Defense Center, is kind of a unique organization. There are a lot of big, national or statewide environmental groups. We are focused just on the Central Coast of California. So San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, and Ventura counties. We've been around for almost 50 years, started in response to the big 1969 oil spill that kind of galvanized the environmental movement in the United States and ended up inspiring some very critical legislation that we still use to this day. And also inspired some really great environmental groups, and EDC is one of them. We started in 1977, so we've been going for almost 50 years here in this area. we're unique in that this model, this type of group, doesn't really exist in many other places in this country. So the Central Coast, Santa Barbara, has this group that is a nonprofit, public interest environmental law firm that has been kind of acting as a legal watchdog and fighting for conservation, fighting for wildlife, biodiversity, fighting against dangerous oil and fossil fuel developments here on the Central Coast for a long time now. And I think we've been very successful overall.
It sounds brilliant to me, and it sounds like we're very lucky. As I understand it, Santa Barbara and the channel itself, the islands, I've heard it called the Galapagos Islands of the Northern Hemisphere. Is that overstating it?
That is very accurate. That was actually a term given to this area by President Franklin Roosevelt, who had studied the Galapagos and then came and visited the channel and the Channel Islands and noted the biodiversity, the ecological richness of this area were located between the cooler northern Pacific waters and the warmer southern Pacific waters. And this is where those waters mix. So we have the highest level of biodiversity in the mainland United States is right here in the Santa Barbara Channel and Point Conception area. So yeah, it's something that it's really important that we acknowledge that and really important that we protect it.
I would say so. And so you started as a result or inspired by an oil spill. And most recently, when I met you, it's about another oil pipeline related issue. But could you sort of back up and tell us, like, what are some cases that you all have prevailed upon? Like, give us a sense of what work you do.
Well, we were founded as a direct result of the 1969 oil spill, which happened because of lax regulations. And so that causes massive blowout, the largest oil spill in the nation's history at the time. It's referred to as a spill that was actually heard around the world. And it spawned this incredible awareness of the dangers of human-caused actions on the environment. And so it was, late 60s, it was January 28th, 1969. And there was a lot of awareness about civil rights and the anti-war movement and other causes like that. So this community was already galvanized around protest and action. And when the oil spill happened, people jumped on it right away, not just here, but around the country. Earth Day was formed because of the 69 oil spill. We needed to do teach-ins about the threats and how, we as the public can engage. The environmental studies program at UC Santa Barbara and other colleges and high schools around the country formed to help with education. Other groups formed to do advocacy, and that's where EDC was formed. And then took it to a whole nother level when Congress passed a whole suite of environmental protection laws. A year after the oil spill, Congress passed the very first modern environmental law, the National Environmental Policy Act, which was based on the Santa Barbara Declaration of Environmental Rights, which was written by some professors at UC Santa Barbara. So when the oil spill happened, it really galvanized our community, but the entire country. And Earth Day was started to teach people about how important it was to take care of the environment and ecology and start a series of teach-ins that exist to this day. And colleges like the University of California at Santa Barbara and high school started environmental studies programs. And in Santa Barbara, some professors from the university drafted what's called the Santa Barbara Declaration of Environmental Rights. Because there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution or Bill of Rights about the environment, but also about protecting public health and safety. And so they wrote the Santa Barbara Declaration of Environmental Rights. It was read into the congressional record and became the foundation of the very first modern environmental law, the National Environmental Policy Act, which if you look at the findings of that law, say, we need to live in harmony with nature. We need to have an ecological conscience. We need to make sure our actions do not harm the environment and set up a process to make sure that agencies consider the consequences of their actions before they make decisions. Because what happened in 1969, Union Oil had requested an exemption from the requirement to case their entire well when they do their drilling. And so when they had a blowout, there was no casing there to contain the oil, and it just spewed into the environment and into the ocean. And by some reports, it continued spewing for about a year. So it was a massive oil spill. So the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, says, hold on, you know, before an agency makes a decision like waiving that requirement, they have to go through an analysis, and they have to hear from the public, and they have to hear from other agencies and experts, and determine, you know, what the potential environmental impacts might be. Can they be avoided? Is there another way to, you know, move forward with this activity that will either avoid all the impacts entirely or at least reduce them significantly? So we take that for granted now. You know, we talk about environmental review, and in California, we have our own version, the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. That didn't exist before the 69 oil spill. And then in short order, Congress passed the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, coastal protection laws, Marine Mammal Protection Act, all within a few years. And that may seem, you know, crazy now. It's really hard to get laws passed, but within the first, you know, 3 to 4 years, all those laws were passed with bipartisan support, signed by President Nixon, a Republican. And in California, we had the California Environmental Quality Act and the Coastal Act, again, bipartisan support, signed by a Republican governor, Ronald Reagan. So with all of these new laws intended to prevent environmental harm, EDC was formed to support other organizations. Some of them also formed from the oil spill, like Get Oil Out and Community Environmental Council. But we were formed specifically to give all of these other organizations the tools that they needed to prevent another disaster and to protect our region. And so that's why EDC was formed. We represented more than 140 organizations throughout our history.
Wow. Okay. So you, all these acts, see, I'm not that clear what an act is versus I hear law and I also hear act. Can you explain that to me? Because if I'm a listener, I don't know what that means. Is an act something that is durable legally, or is it liable to come and go with the administrations? I'm concerned. I'm hearing you say there was a lot of bipartisan support at that time that they were created. Are they fairly durable?
All of these laws were passed by Congress, and when a law is passed, it becomes an act. So you have the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act. It's another word for law, or sometimes you hear the word statute. They're all interchangeable, and they are fairly durable because to change them requires another act of Congress. So you have to go through the House, you have to go through the Senate. You have to go through all of the committees. You have to get to the president's desk. So all of those laws that were passed in the early 1970s still exist in, you know, almost the same form as they did when they were originally passed.
All right. So we have faith that they'll hold up. So 140 organizations, but your law firm is not funded by the government, even though these are laws that the government did pass. Can you explain that a little bit? I'm kind of curious how you're set up to operate. Like, where do you get funding? Who supports you? I hear 140 organizations.
We are a law firm, and we represent these other groups that, as you know, they are our clients. However, we don't charge our clients like a normal fee, like a private law firm. We provide free or very low cost service to our clients. That's kind of our model. So we rely 100%. We rely mainly on donations from individuals and grants from foundations. As you said, Stacy, we do not apply for or accept any money from any government agencies because we don't want to have a conflict of interest if we end up in litigation with one of these agencies. So we're mainly funded by just regular people who want to support this work and want to protect the Central Coast.
And we are a nonprofit ourselves. So we were formed as a nonprofit, and that's how we're able to do fundraising. And some of our clients will, you know, assist with that fundraising, but we certainly want not to make that a requirement.
Right. Well, so we need more people to know about you because it sounds like this is really important. So tell me about some of the cases, because I know in general, you've had a broader spectrum of issues that you deal with, from protecting the channel, clean water, open space wildlife, climate and energy, and that may be focusing now. But I'd love to hear a little variety of some cases where you've prevailed.
Maybe we can talk about some of our recent cases. This year, at the beginning of this year, we won a case against Exxon in court to stop them from doing this massive oil trucking program that they wanted to do here in Santa Barbara County, which would have allowed them to restart their old 1980s era offshore platforms off of the Gaviota Coast. Those have been shut down since the last big oil spill in this part of the state. That's an example where we go up against some of the most powerful countries in the world and some of the most powerful government agencies in the country. And this is just one example. We've been doing this throughout our history. There's been a lot of cases where we take on the kind of most powerful entities that are out there. For example, recently we had a case that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court that resulted in a ban on offshore fracking in the channel, which is huge because these companies had a lot of permits to frack and do other forms of extreme drilling off the coast of California, and now they're not able to do that. We stopped the building of a new dirty power plant in Oxnard. We've stopped oil and gas projects all up and down the coast. We're not just focused on fossil fuels. As you said, we have kind of a bigger portfolio. We're working with some other groups right now to protect some parts of the Los Padres National Forest from commercial logging. We've done a lot of conservation, as you said, of open space and agricultural land here in Santa Barbara County. Some of the really kind of iconic places that people know about here on the Central Coast, like Gaviota, like Elwood Mesa, Carpinteria Bluffs. Linda, I'm sorry, what am I missing?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, we've saved over 100,000 acres permanently from development throughout our service area, all the way from Amundsen Ranch in Ventura County and Ormond Beach down in Ventura County and Oxnard Shores. And then, yes, Carpinteria Bluffs, Douglas Family Preserve, Elwood, heading up north, Sedgwick Ranch, Burton Mesa, and then most of the Hearst Ranch was proposed for massive development of resorts and commercial and equestrian and three golf courses. And in that case, we went up against the Hearst Corporation, which is quite powerful. So when we take a case, we don't look at who the opponent is, you know, in terms of thinking, oh, like, you know, are we going to be able to stand up to them? We just look at the case on the merits. What are we trying to protect? And, you know, what tools do we have at our disposal? And we go for it. And, you know, we've prevailed against, you know, Exxon, Chevron, ARCO, Shell, BHP Billiton, NRG, Phillips with their oil train project we defeated. So yeah, we have almost 100% success rate because we rely on good laws and we match them with solid, credible science. So every case involves, you know, maybe, you know, new laws or regulations we haven't dealt with before, but also we have to bring in, you know, the experts to tell us, you know, what are the harms? You know, what are the public health harms? What are the harms to the environment? What species, what habitats, what watersheds, what pollutants are going to, you know, create more asthma in the community? So, you know, we do a really credible job of doing our research and then very aggressively prosecuting these issues.
This is so impressive. I mean, it's so David and Goliath seemingly. Is it?
It is. That's how we're often referred to.
I love that. I mean, I think we all do love that. Okay, so I want to ask, when you mention Elwood Mesa, which is near my ranch where I live, or Carpinteria Bluffs, I know that Elwood, that is a hatching location for monarch butterflies, which are endangered, I believe. I'm not sure. But can you say why preserving or saving this land, protecting it matters, other than just like it's beautiful, but it's actually more important than just that?
We have saved more than 100,000 acres of open space that was threatened with development throughout the three counties that we serve. And in some cases, you know, the main issues have been, you know, protection of the environmental resources for their own sake. So at Elwood, protecting the monarch butterfly grove is really important. That's one of the most important overwintering sites for the Western monarchs in the United States. And it's really important that we protect that. The development that was proposed there would have just decimated that population. You know, that was probably the main driving factor why, you know, we were hired to stop that project. A lot of these coastal areas include really important streams. Some of them are steelhead streams, so they're very important for another endangered species. There's a lot of wetlands and important foraging habitat and grasslands. So if you protect those, you may provide protections for dozens of other, you know, wildlife species that are important for a variety of reasons, for pollination or for wildlife viewing or, you know, for whatever reason. I would say another reason why we have so much support for these efforts is because they're also really important for public enjoyment and recreation. So all of these places, then we also preserve public access, which had they been developed, would have been severely reduced. So, you know, making sure that these are places that we protect the environment, we also make them available to the public to enjoy and serve as stewards. So two areas that we're still working on after decades and decades are Moore Mesa and Naples. Both of those are threatened with development, and we've been able to stave that off. But I wanted to mention those because those are areas that are still vulnerable, and we still need to fight really hard to protect them.
So the health benefits and mental, physical, emotional benefits of people having nature spaces, I mean, there's a lot of research on that. I'm a psychologist. I know about that as a fact. But also, it sounds like the ecosystem, which it's hard for the average person to sort of factor all that in. But this actually, you know, the knee bones connected to the, you know, elbow bone or whatever, like everything actually is connected, you know, and so it matters on a lot of different levels, as well as just beauty. Our area is actually unique in that as well, but many, many layers to that. So thanks for clarifying. Tell me about some of these tools you use. Like, I'm curious. So you use science and laws, and so you just put in the time, and research is a big aspect of what you do. Is that true?
Yes. Every time we get a new case, you know, the first thing we do is we look at, you know, say like, you know, when we defeated the Exxon, you know, trucking proposal, you know, what approvals do they need from which agencies? And then we look at what laws apply to those agencies, and maybe, you know, there's a law that protects coastal habitats. And then we'll bring in biologists to analyze whether or not, you know, this particular project might impact certain, you know, coastal habitats like wetlands or, you know, creeks and rivers and native grasslands or, you know, endangered species. And then we match those. And, you know, in California, we have one of the strongest environmental protection laws in the nation in the California Coastal Act. And the California Coastal Act says very clearly that any kind of new development, whether it's industrial or residential or commercial, you know, cannot harm those types of resources, that they are important to the state. And we're already losing most of our wetlands and coastal habitats. And so we're able to utilize some very strong laws. Clean Air Act is really strong. Endangered Species Act is really strong. But those laws, they need an advocate to voice, you know, those protections to the decision makers. It's not going to happen by itself.
So there may be a law in place, but if you don't bring it up, somebody can skirt that law and put something through. Does that weaken the law itself if you don't catch them at it?
Well, that's why we need watchdog organizations like EDC and our clients, because, you know, agencies, the governmental agencies are supposed to be the ones that implement and enforce the laws. And sometimes they are really strapped for resources. Sometimes maybe they don't have the political will. We'll see what happens the next 4 years, but, you know, we've encountered that before. So that's why it's important to have the public engaged at the same level. And so, for example, we fought a proposal by BHP Billiton, the largest mining company in the world, wanted to import liquefied natural gas from other countries like Australia and Malaysia and Indonesia to the Pacific coast of the United States. And they picked Oxnard out of the entire Pacific coast because they thought this was a community of, you know, predominantly Latino, low-income residents. There was no way they would be able to stand up, but we were hired. And so we looked at all the laws that apply, and we hired our own experts, and we ended up showing that the safety impacts were 4 times greater than the agency's analysis. And when they redid their evaluation, they ended up agreeing with us. Similarly, it was the EDC that pointed out that under the Clean Air Act, the emissions from this massive floating terminal with these massive ships coming in was going to exceed the requirements of the local clean air plan. They just couldn't get the permits. But we had to, you know, look at all of these different avenues and, you know, find out where the vulnerabilities were. We did end up defeating that project, even though it was supported by President Bush and Governor Schwarzenegger. But we still defeated it by looking at all of these different requirements.
Now, it seems to me, as time passes in the last 50 years, we've become more and more aware of the negative impacts of some of these disruptions to the environment. And yet it seems like you're having to work harder and harder. Like, why do you have to work this hard? I guess it's just like anything else. There's a law in place. Some people still speed if they can get away with it. Part of me, I don't know, I must be a Pollyanna, but I'm like, really? We're going to do something egregiously damaging to a large number of people? I mean, that oil spill we had even 10 years ago, which is going to actually kind of link us to the most recent issue. I mean, what was the impact of that? That was a local thing that had impact how far from the source again?
Do you want to answer it?
I was going to defer to Linda because she was actually there, responded to that oil spill on the day that it happened. But to answer your question, that was a major oil spill. It spread about 150 miles down the coast of California, you know, destroyed thousands of acres of coastal habitat, killed, you know, hundreds of marine mammals, including whales and dolphins, you know, hundreds of birds, closed beaches, hurt businesses. And it was a real national disaster. To go back to your question about the awareness of sort of the harm that these businesses cause, I think that's kind of the business model. You know, as long as we've had offshore oil, there have been offshore spills into the ocean. As long as there's been oil operations next to homes and schools, we've had, you know, kids with asthma. We have all kinds of health impacts on those communities. And that has been part of the model for these fossil fuel businesses going back, you know, more than 100 years now.
And they have budgets to fight this, right? Don't they just work that into the profit model?
Well, some of them do. Like with the recent oil spill, it cost the company that owned that pipeline, Plains All American, it cost them $750 million. You know, it could be part of their business model. They're a national company. Who knows what their overall revenue stream is. On the other hand, you have all of the major oil companies selling off their California assets to smaller companies. And what happens there is they go bankrupt. You know, they can't pay that much money. And so, for example, you know, off of Santa Barbara and Ventura counties, pretty much all the major companies that used to be here, like ARCO and Shell and Chevron and such, they're gone. And they sold to smaller companies like Greca and Venico that went bankrupt. And then who's left holding the bag, either from an oil spill or just when they walk away and they don't plug their wells and they don't clean up all the contamination, it falls to the taxpayers. So whether it's a large company saying, you know, we're not going to be careful because this is part of our business plan, or whether it's a small company that says, well, we don't care because we're not going to be around to clean it up. Either way, it's not only an environmental travesty, but it's also a big economic problem.
So this keeps you guys really busy. Like the word watchdog, that's a busy job, watchdog and all this.
That's what we're here for.
Well, someone's got to do it.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, there's no end to the opportunity, huh?
This is why we're here. And we love what we do. And we love the results. We love the success. Several years ago, when Phillips wanted to bring tar sands oil from the Dakotas in Canada, you know, transport it by rail to their refinery in Napomo in southern San Luis Obispo County. And, you know, there were other, you know, groups and environmental law firms involved, but none of them raised the point that this project was in the coastal zone and it was in violation of the Coastal Act. So, you know, we got hired kind of late in the process, and then we were the ones that ended up killing it because we just know, we know these laws so well. We know how important it is to protect our coast and inland areas like the forest and watersheds. But, you know, we are often the go-to, you know, even when there's other, you know, organizations and even other law firms involved.
Does the work that you do, does it influence people in other areas? I mean, do you make examples that other people can draw from in other areas?
We try to, and a good example was that issue, the liquefied natural gas project, because that was one of many projects proposed at the time. Back then, we were told we had a gas shortage and had to import natural gas. Now we're being told the opposite, but there were other places that were facing similar threats. And so we were able to, you know, refer them to our experts and give them all of our analyses and really just spend a lot of time with them walking through the process and what they needed to do. So we do try to make ourselves available and accessible. And then on a couple of our big cases, that one included, we wrote law review articles to try to inspire law students and other lawyers. You know, these are these tools that are available and here's how you can use them. So we do try to spread the message so that other communities can have that kind of empowerment as well.
And I would just add that we also work with our local elected officials to pass legislation, statewide legislation. We do try to have a statewide impact in that way. For example, this year we worked with Senator Limon on a bill to make it harder for oil companies to poison drinking water aquifers, which sounds crazy that you would need a law to prevent them from poisoning drinking water aquifers. But there's a case like this happening here in Santa Barbara County. There's a proposal by the oil industry and by the state to allow companies to inject toxic waste water below the Cat Canyon Aquifer, which provides drinking water for about 190,000 people up in North County. And so we've been working on that, trying to stop that from happening for a few years now. This year, we were able to work with Senator Limon's office to pass this bill, which the governor signed, to make it a lot harder for these companies to do this kind of thing.
Yeah, it makes the whole company's mission statement criminal in a way. Like, I just don't get that. But I mean, that sounds naive of me, I know. But there's a lot of collateral damage that is acceptable. It sounds like energy, broadly speaking, energy is a main one, right? That allows for collateral damage.
Yeah, I would say, especially in our region, you know, that is such a big threat because we have the oil and gas resources here. But we've also done a lot of work to protect communities and farm workers from pesticide exposure. That's been a big issue of ours. And there are other threats as well, but I would say because of where we are, oil and gas is definitely a big threat and seems to keep rearing its head.
Gosh, pesticides and herbicides is big with me. I saw a paper written where it's a racial issue as well. It was drawing lines there.
It's definitely an environmental justice issue in that some communities are much more heavily impacted either because they are right in the path by serving as farm workers, or they live right next to the fields. We worked with then Senator Hannabeth Jackson to pass a law requiring notification to adjacent like schools and hospitals and residential areas before pesticide applications. It's something that would go through the county ag commissioner, which hadn't happened before. So her law allowed counties to develop these notification programs, and we've been trying to strengthen that law ever since. We filed a lawsuit to try to ban methyl bromide, which is a very, very toxic fumigant used in like strawberry fields and tomato fields. We work across a lot of areas to try to protect the community.
So I want to ask you about this current issue going on that I joined a call for. It's a big deal, and in some ways it's returned back to an old issue, is it not?
Yes and no. I think that, you know, we kind of started off by talking about how our organization started in response to the 1969 oil spill, and we're kind of full circle now trying to prevent another major oil spill on the coast. But it's not really full circle. It's just a continuous line. There's, you know, been two national disasters here in Santa Barbara, the 1969 spill and the 2015 spill. And then there's just been countless other small accidents and spills and leaks and, you know, other harms from the industry over the years. So it's not that we're back to where we started. It's that this has been a continuous kind of issue here in this part of the state. So we are still fighting this. So now there's this new oil company from Texas called Sable that is trying to restart all of Exxon's old equipment on the Gaviota Coast. And when I say old, I mean that Exxon formerly owned it and that it's old. These platforms were built to last about 30 years. It's been 40 or so since they were built. So they're already past the date that they were supposed to be phased out. And all of that equipment includes the pipeline that burst back in 2015 and caused the last major spill here, the Refugio oil spill that we talked about. So this new company, which as Linda talked about, is, you know, they're not like Exxon. They don't have billions of dollars to deal with problems if and when something goes wrong. They don't have any other assets except for these platforms and pipelines and processing facilities on the Gaviota Coast. If something goes wrong, which we think it will, if they're able to use this pipeline again, then they go bankrupt. And as Linda said, the state would be on the hook for, you know, whatever the cost of dealing with this disaster would be. So it is a step backwards. That's correct. It's a step backwards to a time when the oil industry could kind of get away with whatever it wanted to do. So this company is trying to restart this pipeline. They're just patching it up to try to get it just, you know, up to the point where they can run oil through it. And it's a very scary project, because if they start using this pipeline again, we know it's going to break again. Even the county of Santa Barbara hired experts to look at this, and the county's experts said, if you use this pipeline again, most likely there will be a spill every year and a major rupture every 4 years. I mean, even Exxon 10 years ago after the last spill didn't want to reuse this pipeline. They proposed building a new pipeline because they knew this pipeline wasn't safe. So now we're at this very kind of scary point where this new company with no assets, no ability to remediate another spill, if and when it happens, is trying to start this whole operation up. And when you have that much risk involved, of another disaster, it makes this a very critical issue for us here on the Central Coast.
Well, it seems to me that as terrible as that sounds and daunting and damaging as that sounds, like it's guaranteed to be, that the state of California would have a stake in this and would want to join the fight. Do you ever partner with the state of California? Is that a thing you can do?
That's an excellent question. So, I mean, here we are, the state of California is getting, you know, geared up for the Trump administration and, you know, the threat of maybe more oil leasing and development off our coast, which is what, you know, Trump proposed last time he was in the White House. So you've got California revving up and we're going to protect the California coast, you know, against the Trump administration, including, you know, against more offshore oil and gas development. And yet there are several state agencies that could say no to Sable. So Sable needs approvals from almost a dozen different agencies, local, state, and federal. The one agency right now with a lead role in deciding whether or not that pipeline that ruptured can restart or not is the fire marshal. The fire marshal oversees pipeline safety. And they are looking at it with blinders. They're just going to, you know, like look at, you know, what kind of repairs are done, run some tests, and decide if the pipeline can restart. We're saying they have to look at all of the impacts from restarting that pipeline. They have to conduct environmental review. They have to allow the public to weigh in. They have to hear from other agencies. So far, they have said no. So we're not giving up. We're still going to push this. But other state agencies that are involved are the Coastal Commission, which has been awesome. When Sable started conducting some of these repairs and putting in some new equipment in the pipeline without permits, the county was supposed to require permits and did not. So the Coastal Commission stepped in. They can step in at least for the portion of the pipeline that runs along the Gaviota Coast, and they issued a stop work order. Sable violated that. So then the Coastal Commission followed up with another order threatening fines and penalties. And finally, Sable stopped. So all the work on the pipeline is on hold. The Coastal Commission is telling Sable they do need to come in and get permits. So we're waiting for that. Other state agencies that are involved include the State Lands Commission, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, etc. So we are working at all those levels, but it goes back to that bigger picture of, you know, what does the state want here? And, you know, we've sent a letter to Governor Newsom last week signed by 130 organizations, including businesses like Patagonia, saying, hey, you know, state, you got to step up. You can't say no to the feds and then be hypocritical and allow not just the pipeline to restart, but to restart the three platforms, which were the three platforms and the processing plants were by far the county's largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. And I know Alex is going to want to talk more about the climate impacts of this project, but we need the state to step up. And so Assemblymember Hart and Senator Limon have been trying to get, you know, more responsiveness from the fire marshal. And so there will be a public informational meeting in Santa Barbara after the first of the year, where the fire marshal and some of the other agencies will come to Santa Barbara, explain what the different requirements and processes are. But we are still going to demand a formal public hearing. We don't think these agencies can make decisions without having to consider, you know, from the public and what the laws required. So we want people to come to this meeting, but we don't want people to think this is the be all and the end all. So we want people to show up, make your voices heard. You know, these folks are coming to Santa Barbara specifically to hear from us. So we need to really rally the troops for this public informational meeting.
So I will just say that the best way to do that is sign up for our email newsletter. We send out, you know, alerts about these kinds of events. We'll send out information about this meeting that the state is going to have. We really want to mobilize people to be there and to tell state agencies what this community is worried about and what we want them to do.
Well, you've got me very worked up about this. I mean, this is really disturbing and upsetting because not only is it potentially a spill in the water, the marine area, but the last spill, as I think I remember, was on land and then leaked down coast into the water. So it's both land and sea. I mean, the damage. And then you've got a company like Sable that doesn't have the assets or the finances to then do the mitigation or the cleanup. And then the state of California is like, I don't know. You know, how is that possible? No. I mean, do they have to deal with it? Did they deal with it 10 years ago? Is that who dealt with it?
It's even scarier, believe it or not, than what you just recapped. Because Sable, as Alex mentioned, Sable doesn't own anything. Sable is putting all their eggs in one basket. So when they bought this project from Exxon, they borrowed most of the money. They owe Exxon $790 million that they have to pay back with 10% interest. So when they restart, they have 90 days to repay ExxonMobil. So they're starting out almost $800 million in debt. And they're trying to raise, you know, money. They're publicly traded. But they're in debt right now, and they have to operate these massive facilities safely. And then on top of that, when there's an oil spill, which we know there's going to be because they're using this damaged pipeline and the county's own analysis says there'll be a spill, they don't have $750 million like Plains did to clean it up and compensate everyone. This is not hypothetical. We know what's going to happen.
This is like an environmental crime movie that I would watch. I mean, there's so much financial motivation. The stakes are so high. Somebody could get hurt here. I mean, it's like you wonder, like, who are these people?
As Linda said, on top of the possibility of another major spill, when this system of the processing facilities, the offshore platforms, when that was operating 10 years ago, it was the single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Santa Barbara County by far.
When it was operating properly, it was?
Yeah, when it was operating before the last spill, when these processing facilities in Las Flores Canyon were operating, they were responsible for, I believe, more than half of all greenhouse gas emissions in the county. Right now, the county's policy, their climate action plan, is to reduce emissions by 50%. So if we turn this operation back on, that is going to increase the emissions by at least 50%. It totally blows our climate goals out of the water here in Santa Barbara County. And it definitely impacts the state's climate goals as a whole. I mean, the state is supposed to be a leader, not just for the country, but for the entire world. California is supposed to be leading on climate change. And we are in many ways. But it's hard to be a leader on climate change and allow a project like this to go forward, where it's going to, you know, have this high risk of an environmental and economic disaster. And at the same time, we know it's going to add so much to our emissions that it's going to make it that much harder to reach these ambitious goals that California has. So right now we feel like some of the state agencies are kind of sleepwalking towards this cliff. We just want them to stop. We want them to do a full environmental review.
Open their eyes.
Yeah, wake up to this and really look at what is in the public interest here, not just what's in the interest of this little fly-by-night Texas oil company that's not even based in California.
I know, my God. Well, so every day that things go well, we're causing greenhouse gases, with the end result being there's going to be an oil spill and destroy a bunch of the natural habitat and environment on the coast, which is going to hurt a lot of businesses. It's going to create a lot of cleanup that's going to be highly costly, going to harm a lot of lives. So there's county, there's city, there's state, there's every reason for everybody to be up in arms about this. Am I right?
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, a lot of businesses were impacted. Fishing for 138 square miles was shut down for a couple months. You know, all those public beaches were closed. State parks were closed. I don't know if you remember, but it was devastating to the hotel industry, the lodging, the recreation industries. And yet, a lot of those businesses, and I'm not faulting them, but a lot of them cannot speak up now in the context of this project because they were involved in litigation to be compensated for their damages. And as part of the settlement, they agreed to, you know, take their compensation and to not oppose this project. So, you know, a lot of the, you know, folks like the fishing folks and the tourism folks that you would think would be standing up in arms. And again, I'm not blaming them at all. You know, they needed to be made whole, but some of those voices have been silenced, not all of them. So it's really important for, you know, the ones that can speak up. You know, we're very grateful, you know, to Patagonia for, you know, sticking its neck out here, but we can't lose sight of the fact that the whole community was impacted. In fact, you know, I have friends and colleagues that run some of the, you know, tourism businesses. And even though they were not even close to any closed areas, no one was coming here because all they heard was, you know, Santa Barbara, oil spill. It had a massive economic impact as well.
Right. Our natural resources are a real draw for tourism, the natural beauty here. Yeah. So you're also saying then that people that were part of the last spill had a lawsuit, and when they were compensated, they agreed to never sue again if they did it again? I mean, what?
No, didn't go that far. So the final settlement was such that they were compensated for the 2015 spill, and they agreed not to oppose the restart. If there is a restart allowed, another oil spill, yeah, they could sue again. But you know, they didn't have a whole lot of leverage in making that decision. It was, you know, either, you know, be compensated and make this agreement or not be compensated. And for some people, you know, they lost a lot of money. So I don't fault them at all, but we need to speak for them, basically. You know, we need to remind people what the harm was.
Yeah. And there's enough of us that need to get on board here that we can speak up. And so we'll provide in the notes access to how to sign up and subscribe to your newsletter so we can get the information we need, you know, because people just need, you know, notes and, you know, this is what I want to speak to. And you'll give us information on how to speak up about this and how to show up for the community. This is scary stuff.
And I would just say this community has a lot of clout. We want the governor and the Secretary of Natural Resources, Wade Crowfoot, to, you know, step in here and to say, we're not going to allow this kind of project to happen as we are trying to phase out this era of offshore oil in California, as we're trying to phase in offshore wind and sustainable energy. And so I think we can do that. It's just, we have to have this be a community-wide effort. So we're trying to really mobilize here. That's exactly what we need.
It seems to me that could you guys help us create more laws that just keep this stuff out? Like, isn't that appropriate at some point?
I'm glad you brought that up because there's actually a couple federal bills right now. Representative Carbajal has one, and our U.S. senators have a couple that would protect, you know, anything from the West Coast to the California coast from any more offshore oil drilling. But they sit. But yes, there are some federal bills that we support. At a state level, we helped write the California Coastal Sanctuary Act in 1994 with then Senator Jack O'Connell that prohibits the state from issuing any more approvals for offshore oil development within the state's jurisdiction, which goes from the beach out 3 miles. So since 1994, we've had that protection. The federal government has authority, though, beyond 3 miles and, you know, can continue to allow new development. And that's why this change in administration is so important. We helped write the 1994 state law. Also, during the last Trump administration, we worked with Hannah Beth Jackson, who was our state senator at the time, to pass a bill that prohibits the state from approving any infrastructure like pipelines in state waters to support new federal development. That's when the Trump administration was proposing even more oil leases and development. And so Senator Jackson got a bill passed that would prevent anything new. So they would have to rely on, you know, just the existing pipelines, but couldn't build anything new. Now we're going to try to get another law passed to expand on that and say you can't even use the existing infrastructure for new offshore oil development in deeper water. So we do get very involved, you know, trying to make the laws even stronger. The Sable situation is challenging because it already exists. You know, the platforms already exist and the pipelines and the processing plants. But, you know, we do think existing laws should prevent them from restarting. So we are, you know, advocating for that. And if we can strengthen, you know, any laws to help us, you know, we're certainly looking at that as well.
Well, I'm curious to know if environmental law, so your special interest, like a public interest law firm, you had told me it was similar to like the ACLU, you have specific interest. Is this a popular up and coming interest for law students? Is it a growing field?
I hope so. There are some national environmental public interest law firms. Some people may have heard of like Earth Justice, Natural Resources Defense Council, Center for Biological Diversity, Sierra Club. You know, all of those firms have lawyers as well. And they operate, you know, throughout the country. I think what makes EDC unique and why we need more EDCs is our regional knowledge and focus. So we have been so successful because we know how to apply the federal laws, but we also apply the state laws and the local ordinances and policies. And you really need all of that. Like I mentioned in our defeating that liquefied natural gas project, we use the Ventura County air plan. So you really need to know everything from local to state to federal to really be effective. And that's why I wish that there were more law firms like EDC around the country.
Yeah, like specialize in your region. I was just talking to somebody recently about Minnesota and those lakes and those waterways. And I know I did Al Gore's climate reality program up there. And that's a very important region to the rest of the country as well. So I think there's these crucial zones that it actually matters even more.
Yeah. And there is a firm kind of like ours there in Wisconsin, I think, that tries to help cover that area. But yeah, we need more of them.
It'd be so cool if you could take your model and incubate it in other places. That would be a cool goal. You guys are busy enough as it is. Well, so this is a big case. It's on deck. We're looking at January. We've got some things to do here. So what do you want to tell us, listeners? What do we need to know going forward? How can we help ourselves and you?
I would say, if you want to get involved in this, a good place to start is to sign up for our email list, and we'll keep you updated on what's happening, and we'll let you know about any events or hearings that are coming up, opportunities to testify, if we're sending, you know, a letter or something to the governor's office, and we need help with that, we can let people know. So really, this is a good source of information about this case, and that's a good place to start. We always want people to get involved by talking to decision makers and by expressing, you know, how they feel about this. And that includes our county board of supervisors, that includes our local elected officials, and it especially includes the governor's office.
And to build off of that, there will be a couple hearings coming up. And so there'll be this informational meeting in January. There'll be a Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors hearing on February 25th. At some point, there will be a hearing before the California Coastal Commission. So those opportunities, we just need to flood these hearings. We had a Planning Commission hearing a few weeks ago, and Sable, you know, bussed everybody in and paid them all, and they filled the hearing room, and we need to flip that. So we need to get people to show up. You don't even have to testify if you're not comfortable. Just be a body, show up, be supportive. And then the other thing is, you know, we are a nonprofit, and this is taking a lot of our resources. And so we definitely also appreciate financial donations, you know, whether it's $5 or, you know, $100,000. Everything adds up. Everything makes a difference. We have our own attorneys on the case. We have our own resident scientist. We have an expert pipeline safety expert that we need to pay. So, you know, I'd say, like Alex said, just, you know, start getting informed, you know, join EDC, participate, show up, and however makes sense for you.
Well, you've got me excited, and I'm definitely, I do a lot of end of the year donations, and so you're on my list. And I'm so thrilled to get to know you and know what you're doing out there and how you've made, you know, where I live and make my home so much safer and more beautiful. So thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for talking to us. As Linda said, we love what we do. You know, we feel really honored to be able to do this work on behalf of the Central Coast and all the communities here. And yeah, we just really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then we have to get a screenwriter on this one because it's a thriller. I mean, really, it's kind of nerdy, but it's also kind of an exciting thriller, both.
Many of our cases are like that, and they take different twists, you know? We don't even know all the twists that are going to come up.
All right, you guys. Well, you're heroes to me. So thanks for being with us, and we'll see you soon. Thank you for tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.